One of the hardest things about becoming an artist is finding an authentic voice, an original style, a path that is yet to be trodden. This path isn't always popular, and it means you might not become a household name. But if you can pull it off, maybe, just maybe, the act of making it new will mean the work will survive beyond the palatable, the accessible, the commercial, and bland. The artists we talk to and about on today's show live on the edge and possess a unique spirit which you can call many things, but you can't call it mainstream.
Hello, everybody.
It's the multicolored cultural laser. We travel the world for the boys and the girls, casting pots of wonder and amazement.
In April, I spent some time at the I Write Festival in Glasgow, which took place in the Mitchell Library. On the final day after the penultimate event, I had the chance to interview two of America's most innovative novelists simultaneously, Ben Marcus and Mark Z. Danielewski. Now, they'd never met before, but their work in pushing the boundaries of what a novel is and how to tell a story seemed to make them fast friends, and they were in jovial spirits when I took them into the oddly darkened stacks where we did our interview. And then this happened. Mark Danielewski will kind of explain, but basically, these two authors got very excited when they discovered some old books about fire and ended up hitting upon an image which made them think about their own experiments with fiction.
We're here with Ben Marcus and myself, Mark Danielewski, and we're in the stacks, and we have just come upon, by chance, we were in the darkness of the stacks, and Ben just threw up a light, and we have discovered that we are in that section devoted entirely to flames.
I actually came in the library earlier and gutted the shelf and restocked it with a series of fake books, including one called Flames, Their Structure, Radiation, and Temperature. That is actually a novel in verse.
Interestingly enough, we have flames, their structure, radiation, and temperature. Their structure, we have a few, but we don't have X flames. I'm looking for those, and also the musical flames.
An introduction to Fire Dynamics. Fire Dynamics is the name of a band, an R&B band, and that's an introduction to their early work.
Oh, where are they from? Like, what's that, Syracuse?
Dayton, Ohio. What's this book?
Look at this. No, I was wrong. Here we go. Flame and combustion phenomena. That was the X relationship, the how to disentangle in a disharmonious way.
Mark, this is the memoir about you, self-ignition, flame, and detonation in, and then it's, what is that
so
word?
True. What period is he?
Gases. that gases is the name of the town where you grew up, right?
Fantastic. Yes, it was translated from Russian, published by the Israel Program for Scientific Translation. This is beautiful. This actually wrote my fate out. Self-ignition was written in 1963. This is actually a prophetic text. I'm
so
very close to it.
So many people should practice self-ignition. It's a shame that went out of style.
Are we screwing
that up?
There's a thin one. And you know these ones. They hide between books, and now we can see what this is. A Digest of Elementary Chemical Thermodynamics by Shireby.
It's a children's book.
It's a children's book?
Love that.
Oh, my God. Beautiful illustration.
The pictures are so amazing. There's a picture of two little boys at a river, and they're exchanging. Is that a hat, or is that a dog?
No, that looks like a pan. Is it a pan? I think it's something was cooking. Oh, the oil is burning the poor child's arm. Oh, that's terrible.
A missing page. What happened there?
Oh, this is back when they used to really name their characters in fun, sort of whimsical ways. Example 35, I think, is a wonderful name for a child.
That got so popular, though.
Yeah, Example 35.
Yeah, it's like Jack is now.
Here's another one, Problems. It's a wonderful, wonderful name.
I wonder where all the board books are.
Have you ever read about spontaneous combustion? Ever thought about that? You ever worry about it?
After you've gone through it three or four times, it's actually not so bad. You don't realize that you do reconstitute. It's just they never show that in the films.
I'm on a medication whose sole purpose is to keep me from worrying too much about self-ignition. Yeah. It's an SSRI. The side effects are pretty bad.
I think my girlfriend is the only one who's against self-ignition, but otherwise she's pro everything
have you guys
I do.
Through that?
Yeah, we have. You know, and in fact, it's this little book. Look at this. This actually keeps us intact. The laws of disorder.
This has saved a lot of relationships. Yeah, this book.
It's good, and so we're solid.
Like if you ever think that you know you're going to get divorced, separate, anything, this is probably definitely the book to read. On the other hand, people also use it to accelerate a breakup.
That's true. I mean, I think what I learned is that not self-igniting is sharing, and so things are good. We have a very thermodynamic.
It's just a lot of personal growth.
Look at that! Did you see the graphics on this book? This is amazing. Look at that. Entropy. Look at that. We have a little chicklet
shell. ? And then a chicklet coming out of the shell?
This particular book, because it was amazing, 20 years ago they didn't understand which was entropy, whether it was just having an egg or an egg giving birth to a chicken. So they were confused still about entropy. Entropy is a fairly...
The chicken came along and actually pecked open the empty egg. And this was very disturbing to them.
And then stood there saying, look at me, you're confused. And that's what the question... Oh, this is brilliant.
Well, the caption to this image is, what'd you think was in there?
Aren't you a little... You assumed a time frame that I didn't allow you to assume. Look at... This is phenomenal.
I'm sick of you and your assumptions.
Oh, and look, this one is reading both our minds. We have a man in silhouette who's eating a banana, and he's thinking exactly our thoughts right now. H2O, CH4, CO2... And nitrogen, hydrogen, 3.
This is an early draft of War and Peace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The whole text.
You know, I think I sense sort of a book that may have been influential on David Sedaris.
Yeah.
Do you see that happening?
This would be the one. That's
a question probably to ask. Let's get that title right for him so that at some point, the Laws of Disorder, Introduction to Chemical Change and Thermodynamics, BBC.
And that looks like, is that George Bush?
I think so.
Have you ever been in the Houston airport? I'm sure you have. Have you seen the skull? Well, it's a bronze sculpture, and it's actually, you know, 1.5 times life size. Right. And he's got his coat over his shoulder, but his coat, instead of draping over his shoulder, goes straight back as if they've captured it, as if he's just thrown it on there.
Wow.
And you just imagine the discussion they had about this and how...
Well,
how pleased they were that the coat wasn't going to fall.
There was movement.
This was movement. But then I think in 1,000 years, that coat's going to break off, and it'll just be this wedge of textile going up, and people are going to guess what that was.
That is such a curious choice. Like, yeah, we should actually find out why, because what it says is the coat is going to fall. I mean, that's what you've taken it to its conclusion. We know when we look at that statue that the coat has to fall.
Well, I was in Rome with my kids recently, and you know, you look at the sculptures and the genitalia is falling off, the arms are falling off, and my son was like, "Dad, you know, why does penis fall off?" And you know, other than the obvious reason, I said, "Well, because it's sticking out and there's nothing holding it up." And so like the limb, like an arm out here, over time it's gonna fall off.
So that's a sad...
I didn't tell him the obvious reason. He's not ready.
Wait, what is the obvious reason?
It's unspeakable.
But that's a sad statement.
Even if I said it, I'd upset myself. I have to live with myself.
He's already upset for having thought that which is obvious. But I think the sad point for us is that anything that's out there, even the slightest out there, falls
anything
off.
Anything
hanging in the air. Exactly.
That's really true.
Get yourself attached.
Back to Donald Judge Cubes. Exactly. He's like, finally, nothing could fall off of this.
That's right.
It's about the only good thing about those cubes.
So basically, I've discovered who our readers are. Our readers are those people who are always curious, like, where is that penis? What does it look like? Where is that arm?
Someone,
what does it look like? We are the pieces that fall off.
All the fallen appendages of the old sculptures. Oh, that's what we've done.
What we've done.
That's our jacket copy.
I don't, for the record, think Mark Danielewski nor Ben Marcus will be pieces that fall off. Anybody who has read their incredible work knows it is likely to be found and treasured, possibly in a dark library, for a long, long time. Ben Marcus's latest book is a collection of short stories titled Leaving the Sea, and his novel The Flame Alphabet is set in a world where children's language has become toxic. And Mark Danielewski's 50-Year Sword has just been published by Glasgow's own Cargo Press, and his debut novel, House of Leaves, is already a classic, a boundary-breaking story told with footnotes within footnotes, an elaborate multi-narrator structure, wild variations of fonts, and just a ripping, ripping yarn, part horror story, part love story. I highly recommend all of these books. Earlier that day, I was thinking about Outsiders because I'd been to see a new play called The Beautiful Cosmos of Ivor Cutler. Now, for those of you who don't know, Ivor Cutler was hard to pigeonhole. I call him a poet because I first heard his distinctive voice on his album Life in a Scotch Sitting Room. But some call him a humorist because he has a sardonic kind of Monty Python surreal humor to him. And some call him a songwriter because he sang, though he rarely did more than play a sparse bit of harmonium over his own distinctive Glaswegian brogue. He reminds me in a way of the cult American author Richard Brautigan, and neither really seemed to get the audience their work deserved. Yet, the work remains. And every so often a lucky explorer finds them and starts saying to their friends, "Hey, have you ever heard of Ivor Cutler?" And of course a lot of people have. John Peel championed his work, and the Beatles featured in their film The Magical Mystery Tour. I sat down with two musicians in the Vanishing Point Theater Company who collaborated in the making of this eclectic and brilliant show about an eclectic and brilliant talent.
Nick Pin.
And Magnus Metter. I play percussion, all kinds of percussion, and a little bit of backing vocals.
I'll play a few stringed instruments and bass pedals.
Let's just start the whole thing by talking a little bit about who Ivor Cutler was and where this production came from.
Yeah, well, I think I first started hearing Ivor Cutler about 35 years ago. It was always just felt a very close affinity with him and his work. I saw him on three or four occasions live. I kind of loved his musicality as well as his the content of his fantastic words and very absurd scenarios. James Fortune, who's the musical director, asked if I'd be involved in it, which was a bit of an early dream come true, really, to be able to be part of a reinterpretation of Ivor's work. We've managed to, I hope, and I think we have, there's been a certain amount, a good variety of dynamics brought into it, because with Ivor's stuff, of course, it was just pretty much him and a harmonium. And so it's a question of we've worked hard at avoiding too much pastiche, except where we felt it really worked.
Yeah, it's really interesting because the way the show is, because I'm glad you said that, because I was sitting there for most of the two-hour performance going, did I miss something? Did Ivor Cutler ever play Calypso music with a full band? But no, he didn't. He was always kind of quite strictly harmonium.
He'd hint at things.
I think what's really interesting when you dig a little bit deeper into what he researched and what he was into, for example, he was interested in African rhythms, African hand drumming, and you can hear a lot of the blues in some of his melodies, and you can hear all sorts of different things that are implied throughout it, which means if you sit together in a room with a bunch of musicians, you can find little threads and little things to work through and work out of his music. Obviously, there are lots of Ivor Cutler fans, and we're just very hopeful that they like what we drew out of it. Well, I quite like it. I think we've done all right, but it's all subjective, isn't it?
But you would say that, yeah.
Well, no. Sometimes I hate what I do, but on this occasion I like it.
Yeah, that's a good thing. I mean, I think what you're doing, which is very interesting, and I think what really the band adds to it is this sort of, I guess in a sense, an amplification of his interests and what you've picked up on, those little subtleties in the kind of performances.
We also know that one of his quotes on his stickers that he used to liberally pass out to people was about how amplification is the curse of the Western world.
I know he'd rather it be silent, but that in itself is really an interesting thing. He was a member of
the Noise Abatement Society.
He was a very, very sensitive soul. I think he found loud noises very, very difficult to deal with.
Actually, that actually brings up a good point that I wanted to ask, and maybe it's Nick, since you saw him perform live, because I never knew of Ivor Cutler, I guess, when he was alive. So what was the perception of him as a performer and as a person, as an artist, while he was living? What was it like to go into one of those cases? Were people going to see poetry? Were they seeing a spectacle?
You were getting a world, actually, a bit like, calling this the beautiful cosmos. It's a great thing. I remember seeing him. I remember one occasion when he walked on stage with bicycle clips on, and he had on one side he had a harmonium, and the other side of the stage he had a piano. And I think the harmonium was wearing a sign that said sewer. And he'd go up with a spray, a little like perfume spray, and keep walking over to it and spraying the air around it. it was a great piece of theatre, really. And you got a feeling that a lot of what he was doing, it wasn't sort of premeditated absurdity. It was just, he did have a few little triggers, I think. Children making a lot of noise, he'd send people out.
I love how in the show that actually you guys bring that together, that the lead actor who plays Ivor Cutler has that.
I think he's got it very good, from my experience of having seen, having seen Ivor Cutler 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, because somebody was rustling some kind of packet, and you know, are you eating out there? You know, it was a really shocking breaking of the fourth wall, and actually, pretty true to, I guess, is it kind of his spirit of just almost schoolmasterly, wasn't it?
Yes.
Magnus, had you been listening to Ivor Cutler before this production, before you got the gig, or
before Jim got in contact with me? I hadn't really heard of Ivor Cutler, but when I started listening to his repertoire and his tunes. Some of them had, by the power of musical osmosis, I'd already heard them in places. So we're like, oh, right, okay, I kind of recognize some of this stuff. But then equally, at that moment, I immediately could see the quality and how strong the material is. So it was immediately very attractive to sort of come up here and spend a month with some great, really great team of people and see what we can make out of what is already really fantastic work, you know.
What is that process like? Because the piece itself isn't I wouldn't call it a straight narrative story. It's a lot more fragmented. It breaks the fourth wall. It kind of also gives you bits of music and bits of poetry and bits of storyline, but it kind of mashes and moves around in a very elegant way. But I was wondering what that process is like and what your involvement in it was.
I mean, I've done various different theatre productions of all sorts, from musicals to straight plays and whatever, and playing music in all those things. What was significantly different about this one is that for the entirety of the devising process that the actors had, the entire band was present the entire time for like a full month. You know, 6 days a week, 10 till 5 every day. And that's quite unusual. It's quite luxurious to have musicians along the whole time. And I think the desire from the director, Matt, was to try and make it a kind of mix between a gig, a theatre show, and a play or a musical. He wanted to try and, like you've just said, thread all these things together. And so it was necessary for us to be there the whole time to achieve that. But, you know, sometimes you're sitting around for 4 hours doing nothing, and other times it's like 5 hours of really, really intense rehearsal, scratching your head, like, I don't know what I'm doing.
And drawing and eating donuts.
I have to eat 8 donuts a week, so I'm going to get a sort of dentist contribution from Vanishing Point at the end of this show.
I also noticed, so you're both involved in the show because you're both very much on stage and on stage as well. Yeah. And Magnus, you know, there's a bit where the door doesn't close and you have the drums seated next to the door. Is that improvised? Is that part of the...
Today it was, yeah, because the hinge wasn't working. But that's what's nice about working with actors. They sort of have this playful kind of way of working, whereas if something goes wrong, then they use that, they make something from it. Rather than panic and sort of go, oh, I don't know, something's gone wrong. They make something out of it.
And also because you've rehearsed 12 hours a day together in the same room, they feel comfortable with both of you addressing things. Even if something goes wrong, you play a clam or something, they could address that and they know you wouldn't be sensitive about it.
There's not the split that I think, that most of us would have expected between actors, musicians, in terms of the ideas and suggestions. It's been pretty democratic, which has obviously come out of having long days, just all being in rooms together, rehearsing stuff, running through things being cut.
Have any of your babies been cut out of the performance?
Oh, yeah, I think we've all had certain bits which we thought, oh, that was quite fun to do. Well, never mind, moving on.
And when you're pitching in, is it just like a conversational kind of thing? Like, oh, hey, I think he would have done this. Or because I guess everybody would have had different strands of reading or viewing or YouTube clips or whatever, listening to records, different entry points.
Yeah.
So, you know, and how would that kind of just, how would you interject those into like the conversation, or what were some of those things have been?
Sort of politely. There's certain guys that lead the process, like Jim's the MD, Matt's the director, you know, Sandy wrote the play. And has done tons and tons of research. So those guys are the kind of linchpin guys within it. But if it's a musical thing, or for me, like a groove thing or a rhythmic thing, I might come up with an idea and chuck that in. Jim might like it, you know. And then you just go with what's making people feel good and what's feeling good to you. And it's a collaboration, you know. You use your ears more than anything else.
What was really interesting to me was how, I guess, I mentioned this already, that there was a lot of instruments. I mean, Nick, you're playing the saw, the mandolin.
There's the mandocello.
Mandocello, yeah, of course it was. I would never have recognized a mandocello.
It's a mandolin, but in a cello register, and bass pedals with the feet. And then I've got fiddle and a couple of other things, uke.
Yeah, but I love the fact that like everybody was doing that, and it seemed to me to symbolize the sort of ability of Cutler to both be a poet and a writer and a bookish guy and a musician and to have all these different interests. And I wonder if they very consciously, did it seem like a conscious thing that you were chosen not just because of your musicality, but your ability to, yourself as well, Magnus, to move around on different percussion instruments. Yeah. You're playing the timpani, you're playing different things.
Well, for example, what's really unique about Nick is you have one guy and he can completely cover the bottom end, like with his bass pedals and can play... has all these electronic looping things that he can do. So he might be just be playing a violin, but he can build up quite a dense harmonic texture just with one guy by sort of layering things on top of each other. And then, so yeah, and all the guitar things, all the ukulele things. So you've got a lot of different textures and colors and sounds that is just coming from one guy.
But then also, I mean, for example, you know, with Magnus as a percussionist, there's not even a standard snare drum there. It's kind of some Arabic kind of thing with some bells underneath it, and the sort of percussion instrument lineup is nothing. There's nothing there which is actually standard, and the vibraphone's there too. So the great thing about, I think, what everyone's doing, and Joe with keyboards and vocals, she's using effects, she's using things, she comes into it from a very, very individual angle. It's not like, none of us are like a covers. What's great about it is that I think I've always had a disdain for tribute bands and things, and none of us have a feeling of doing that. What we're doing is actually celebrating Ivor Cutler.
And I think what comes out, because of the type of musicians that Nick's just described, what's come out is quite, hopefully, quite unique and personal, you know. So hopefully that helps with doing good service to this amazing material, you know.
Yeah, because it's got to be quite a profound responsibility, because his partner, I guess it's never really established, his girlfriend, partner, Phyllis, who's in the play. Yeah. I mean, these are real people care about, not just fans, but actually indeed, family and friends.
Jeremy Cutler, I think it's Ivor's son, was at the first show. Yeah, we were really nervous and about his response, because it's, and I think he enjoyed it. He said he enjoyed it and had a great time. But at the same time, he said he found it really hard, because totally understandable. You know, you're watching a story about your dad, and it must be. I can't imagine what it must be like. But thankfully, he really enjoyed it, I think.
It started up in Inverness. Have you done it outside of Scotland? And
this is now very early days. So we had the week production rehearsals and a couple of previews in Inverness, the Eden Court.
We'd love to be
in Edinburgh. But I mean, I think we're all hoping that it would just, it can carry on.
Because yeah. I really wonder, because I sat there thinking, I came to Ivor Cutler, I guess, you know, moved to Scotland as an American. You know, went on a long car trip, somebody put a cassette in, and you're just listening to that thing about them eating, what was the one where they're eating oranges. It's so good, and that just that weird, you know, sucking each segment and all that stuff. And, you know, it just is, it's so evocative to me of, you know, driving through the country, going on a walk in the hills here in this country. And I wonder how that would translate, how you think it might translate to other places, because I know, you know, not just England, but, you know, Spain, Buenos Aires, you know, wherever.
No, I mean, I certainly he had a big following in London, and he spent a lot of his time in London, so clearly there's something there, hopefully. As far as the rest of the world goes, I don't know. I mean, it's
what would they say about it in South Africa? You know, like, just I couldn't get it around my head.
I think the interesting thing here is, unlike, let's say, a folk artist who might be drawing from their immediate surroundings, although Ivor Cutler was clearly Scottish, his locations, what he's talking about, quite often they're quite universal. Walking in a field or going to a farm or something, I think the sky, or looking at the hole in your toe, it's yellow, and you know, it's being able to see through the floor, through the world or something. It's as were the ingredients, you know, for example, you know, the bits of thumb piano or Indonesian sort of gamelan sounds that he incorporate. I think he's never seemed to be regionally bound. And so I think that's why he's actually got almost a universal appeal. But I suppose what it is his timing and his, as I said, the absurdity I think that's universal.
Yeah, I think actually that's a really good point, because I guess now that you say it, they're just very generic tropes in a sense. You know, they've definitely got fields in Germany. You know, they've definitely got cows and zoos and all of those things. I wanted to ask one point, which I don't know if you'll necessarily be able to pick up on, but I was reading in the program where Matthew, who's the director, talks a bit about Cutler leaving Scotland for London, and this notion that he basically asks why he went south and what he left behind. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about that movement of people from Scotland to the big city to London, and then this idea that there's a new generation of people in Scotland that maybe will stay as opposed to leaving. And I guess the idea of exodus, leaving, immigration.
I mean, I understand someone leaving a place where they feel that they can't go any further forward.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, he was signed to record companies like, you know, Virgin and Rough Trade, wasn't he? He was championed by John Peel and BBC generally. So I suppose it's better to be in that vicinity.
I think artists, they're quite introverted in weird backgrounds and often feel sort of left out, like wanderers. And certainly that seems to be the case with Ivor's life. Yet a lot of his work evokes being Scottish in this really strange way. Because I used to live in Scotland. I lived in Scotland. I'm not from Scotland, but I spent a lot of time up here. My mum's actually Scottish originally, although obviously clearly I'm not Scottish. But I can get a real flavour of the essence of being Scottish from his work, which, although he might not have enjoyed growing up here and not had great experiences here, it clearly left a very, very strong impression with him. And that's really, for me, really evident in his work, and like quite striking.
Thanks, Magnus, and thanks, Nick. The Beautiful Cosmos of Ivor Cutler is on now at the Traverse Theatre in Edinburgh till the 3rd of May. Produced by the Vanishing Point Theatre Company and the National Theatre of Scotland in association with Edencourt in Inverness. We'll leave you now with a little more from The Beautiful Cosmos of Ivor Cutler.
Once I was a little boy, I had a rubber toy. Oi, 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 what a toy. I opened up its lips and spat in lots of pips. Now my toy is full of forever. A forest for a toy. What a lovely toy for a very little boy.
Once I was a little girl, my head was in a whirl. I'm a girl. I climbed the slippy tree for all the boys to see, and they gasped at how clever I was. I nearly touched the sky. What a lovely thing to do, to be so very high. We'll be right back.
When the forest grew too big, it burst out of my toy. Lucky me. I give it lots of light, but giddles climb up at night. Now my forest is full of girls. A girl on every tree. What a lovely sight for a little boy like me.
Casting pots of wonder and amazement.